keeping it real on CliffCentral.com.
Please note that the views expressed and the advice provided in this show are for general advice and entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated should be treated as a substitute for your own independent legal advice based on your own specific facts and objectives. Therefore, the presenter and CliffCentral.com accept no liability of any nature whatsoever, either expressed or implied.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg on CliffCentral.com.
Sanbonani, I'm Gary Hertzberg, and this is The Laws of Life on CliffCentral.com. With me again is Kate Pater.
Hi, everybody. Hi, Gary.
Hi, and Duncan Mabaso.
Hi, everyone.
With us also is my candidate attorney, Saul Smith. Welcome to you,
Hi.
Saul.
Hi, Gary.
Good to have you in studio. Good. Today, we also joined in studio by a Pretoria woman called Marianne Castles. She was, hello, Marianne. She was viciously savaged by a dog in Pretoria, and as it happens, the dog was owned by a diplomat. So today we'll be discussing diplomatic immunity and how far this law extends in protecting foreign diplomats.
And their dogs.
Yeah. Good. Later in the show, we'll be talking about what you should know and what to do when stopped at a roadblock, according to an article that appeared in the Times a few days ago entitled, and I quote, "Expect Roadblocks Galore." I've asked Howard Demboski of the Justice Project of South Africa to talk to us about hairy and scary roadblocks.
Well, he's always entertaining, so I look forward to that.
I think you're going to want to join with us today. As usual, 0861-555-189. You can message us, you can Skype us, you can tweet us at HertzLaw, HERTZLAW. Now, the issue of diplomatic immunity is extremely topical right now, as we have our own South African diplomat who's in big trouble in Norway, or is he? I don't know. And on the line, we're going to speak to DA spokesman for international relations and cooperation, Stevens Mokgalapa. Welcome to you, Stevens.
Thank you very much for having me, and good afternoon to your listeners.
Good to have you. I know you're waiting for the big result in the Concord, which is expected very soon. But in the meantime, we've got you. Stevens, one of our South African diplomats has got into some serious trouble in Norway, as we all know. Apparently, he's the embassy's first secretary and head of political affairs. And according to reports that I've read, he crashed into another car, seriously injuring a 29-year-old female paramedic. And I also think when it came to being breathalyzed, the embassy officials rolled up and they said, no breathalyzing, we are diplomats. And they cited diplomatic immunity. So the question to you is, I know you're following this one very closely. I mean, what is going on? Is South Africa not prepared to waive diplomatic immunity, or what's going on?
Yes, most certainly. I think this is one of the worst diplomatic scandals that you could ever have, because of it's about the integrity of the nation. And diplomats, when they are sent abroad, they are sent to represent South Africa. And anything that they do, they bring the good name of the country into disrepute. And this is a classical example of kind of diplomat that we don't want to represent South Africa. Well, this is a classical case of drunk driving. There's no doubt about it. The third diplomat was very much drunk. He is the first secretary of political affairs. So he's quite a senior diplomat to be engaged in such things. Well, in terms of the Vienna Convention, Article 29, it provides that the person of a diplomatic agent shall be inviolable. He shall not be liable to any form of arrest or detention. The receiving state shall treat him with due respect and shall take all appropriate steps to prevent any attack on his person, freedom, or dignity.
Yeah.
This is the convention of that gives diplomatic immunity to diplomats.
I mean, Stevens, when you really think about it, Norway has been a very good friend to South Africa over the years. I know they've been very generous. They've helped us with many things. You would think that especially they played a heck of a part in the fight against apartheid. Surely South Africa now owes them, the Norwegians, some respect. And they should waive this immunity. Yes.
Yes, Definitely. These are the you know, the conventional rules of diplomacy. But however, it goes beyond that, because Article 32 says the immunity from jurisdiction of diplomatic agents and of persons enjoying immunity under Article 37 may be waived by the sending state.
Yes.
Which means that the sending state is asked South Africa to know where we should be taking disciplinary internal action against the said diplomat and possibly suspending with view of investigating the matter and, you know, if all probable, dismissal. So this is the process that one is following internally to see what the department is going to do in terms of this, because of definitely it has tainted our diplomatic relations that we enjoy with Norway.
This particular guy is back in South Africa, isn't he? The man who had the accident. It's a bit too late to waive it now. He's back. I mean, what can they do against him?
Well, what usually happens is, I mean, the third person was taken into his home, and then obviously the diplomatic, conventions kick in and everything. And then from there, it's up to the sending state to recall that person and say, come home. And face the music.
We're going to be talking to a professor of law on diplomatic immunity generally. He's from UJ. So we're going to go into the law very thoroughly. I just want to check with you one or two things. I mean, there's no secret in South Africa that we're short of water, power and houses, but there's no shortage of ambassadors worldwide. We spend something ridiculous like 3.2 billion rand a year on diplomatic missions around the world. I know you've been quoted as saying that we have the highest number of embassies abroad after the U.S. Yes. Can we afford this enormous cost? I mean, why is this? Is it jobs for pals and all these generous allowances that have been paid to diplomatic staff? What is going on?
I would tell you bluntly, it is jobs for pals, you know, because of we are one of, as you said, the second highest country that has got diplomatic, missions abroad.
Yeah.
And those diplomatic missions sometimes are not usually staffed and manned by quality, credible diplomats who can be able to engage in economic diplomacy or engage in ensuring foreign direct investment to South Africa. But it's seen as if it's a dumping ground for ANC reject because of
that's very brave of you to say.
You know, all these diplomats that are dumped into foreign, service, they are rejected back home, people who are not wanted. And it's sad because of in diplomatic circles, it's a question of tit for tat. What you do to me is what I expect you to do to you, So it's a reciprocal relationship.
The kind of person you send to a country
says much about the relations that you are building with that country and says much about how you perceive that country. So diplomacy should not be seen as a dumping ground for reject. It should be seen as a quality harbor, of people who can be able to represent South Africa.
I think on that very point, Stevens, I think the South African ambassador to Japan is the lady who misrepresented her CV. She claimed to have a PhD, but on investigation was found she never completed her studies. And then also the ambassador to Netherlands is the man who was to blame for the private plane, which, remember the Gupta family?
Oh, goodness.
That's that guy.
There is one in Ghana who's involved in the leasing scandal as well. So the list goes on and on. That is why I'm saying that the wealth of diplomacy in South Africa is a dumping ground for ANC reject. And it's not treated with high quality that it deserves. That is why we don't have enough economic diplomacy going on, because of we sending people who definitely lacks integrity and lacks the quality and fiber that we need to represent us abroad.
Yeah.
And that is why, as the DA, we've been calling for a regulation of foreign service. So there is a foreign service bill that is before Parliament that is coming recently that will regulate situations like this one. And regulate how our diplomats behave and regulate how we appoint the diplomats. It is just a pity that the way of appointment of a diplomat is the prerogative of the president.
Yeah.
So you would present your credentials, the ministry would recommend, and then the president would appoint you.
It all makes sense, Stevens. We appreciate this. Lastly, I know the most expensive mission of South Africa, permanent mission to the UN in Geneva, Switzerland, costs South Africa under 100 million rand a year. I mean, can you imagine what we could do with that money? We could build millions of hundreds of houses and whatever, and we're wasting it on nonsense, you know?
Well, I think diplomacy is quite important, yes, and I do think it's something that needs to be maintained, but not to the tune cost. Of 3.2 billion with, as it's been said, with ANC rejects placed representing our country.
Stevens Mokgalapa, so we're going to let you go. UDA spokesman for international relations and cooperation. Many thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you again.
Thank you for having me. And definitely, I would love to engage you moving forward. But South Africa needs a lean and mean foreign service. We don't need this bloated foreign service. And we can do much more with the cost that is costing us as the taxpayers. Yeah. We can have it, we can make it a thrilling one. And I'll be following up this incident. And I think the state law advisor has also recommended that disciplinary proceedings against the said diplomats to be instituted. So I will be looking forward and keeping a close look at this one.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate it. The just to mention quickly, Cliff Central, and especially us, the Laws of Life, we do not support any particular political party. We just try and bring you the facts and the law as best possible. We want to make that point. Very quickly about, Saul, you may know about this, the Norwegians, the cost of living in Norway, which I found quite interesting. People say, how did our diplomat afford to get drunk in Oslo?
Well, how much does it cost to get drunk in Oslo?
Well, it's 190 Rand just for a beer at some restaurant or other, some petty restaurant.
Yeah, I'm never going to complain about the price of craft beer in South Africa again. 190 bucks, I mean.
That's hectic, isn't it?
It's quite steep, isn't it?
A pack of cigarettes, Kate, 206 Rand right now.
Well, that's horrifying. When we were in the States, it was 10 to 1, and I bolted spending 100 Rand on a box of cigarettes. So I think if I had to move to Oslo, I may have to give up.
A loaf of fresh white bread, 46 Rand. A cappuccino, which is what you love, 70 Rand. So that's the cost of living in Oslo, one of the most expensive for a night out on the town, according to you.
Interesting to know.
Okay, we have a very special lady in studio today. Her name is Marianne Castle. She's from Pretoria, and she had a run-in with a diplomat as well. Her story is very interesting. You're a bit of a leisurely cyclist, aren't you?
That's right, Gary.
What happened one fine sunny day in Waterkloof, is it? Yeah.
Yes, I went cycling just leisurely around Waterkloof. And as I came around the corner, I saw a domestic holding a dog and a couple. And all of a sudden, this dog just jumped at me, grabbed my leg, right round, it tore a lot of meat out of my leg. I stopped and I wanted to know, whose dog is this? And the couple, the lady, the domestic, just didn't want to know who it is. And the couple just said, oh, no, you need to go to hospital. They didn't want to own up anything. They waved a car down, told me to get in this car and go to hospital. They actually just wanted to get rid of me. I didn't know who this couple was. And the domestic just went off with this dog. It wasn't a long leash, that's why it could get hold of me. Yeah. And it really bit me terribly in my leg. I've got big scars.
Yeah. So the dog's mouth actually wrapped around your...
Wrapped around my calf.
Your calf.
Yes.
Yeah. And it got into both sides and it ripped the flesh out of the front and the back of your calf.
That's right.
Sounds quite gruesome.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, my
yes,
word.
Yes, right round, yes. Yeah.
So you must have been in terrible pain. You said there was flesh lying on your shoes or something.
Yes, flesh in my socks and my shoes and blood and everything. Yes, yes, it wasn't nice.
So you were rushed off by a passing car?
By a
passing
car.
And you went
to
a hospital. Were you admitted there or did
they? Yeah, not straight away even. They were full. They couldn't even admit me. Only the next day.
Yeah.
But I was in hospital for 3 days. Yeah. I needed 2 operations. Just because to make sure that there's no inflammation or bacteria or anything.
Mm.
And when I came back, that night, I tried to find out who is this. I tried to think, who are these people? I remember I've seen them somewhere.
You live in that area?
Yes, I live in that area. Yeah. And I believe that dog was also from that, and the owners were from that area.
So you and your husband went on a bit of a tracing expedition.
That's right. And I remembered who they were. I remembered I've seen them walking. They lived right around the corner from me.
Yes.
So we went tracing them, found their house, and they just would not own up. They said, no, it's not their dog. The dog didn't bite
Peter
me.
Peter Sellers said that it's not my dog. It's not my dog.
Although in this circumstance, I think the denial has a far greater consequence.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to break your story. Do you remember that joke? Peter Sellers walks up to a man, he says, does your dog bite?
Yes.
And the guy says, no. And the next thing, the dog savages Peter Sellers. And Peter Sellers says, but you said your dog doesn't bite. He says, not my dog. Anyway, sorry, Murray.
No, that's fun.
Are we making light of something?
So yeah.
Now you go to this very house. Did you know they were diplomats when you got
there? No. Actually, yes. Only then, because we found out in the area that they were diplomats.
Yeah.
So we still went to them, saw the dog on the other side of the gate.
You recognized the dog?
Yeah, we recognized him. Oh. And we waited for the owners to come home. It was after work. And when they came home, they just said, no, their dog did not bite me. And then the lady said, she's a doctor. She said, that's not a dog bite. I said, what?
Well, how did she know? Weren't you bandaged?
I was bandaged.
Yeah.
And all. So
X-ray vision.
Yeah.
Must have been.
Yeah. Yes. And so I said, well, what is it, a lion then? What could it be?
Yeah.
But yeah, they would just not own up. And they said, no, it's not them. And my husband got so cross.
So,
let's go.
The domestic worker was holding the dog on a leash, and this couple was standing with them.
Yeah, she was. They were working with.
Now, that very lady who was holding the dog, did you see her at the house of the diplomats?
No, it was another domestic was at the house.
But you were sure that that was the couple? There was no
doubt
about
it? Yes, definitely. I recognized them, definitely.
Okay, and there you saw the dog. So it all fits together. They are the owners of the dog.
That's right.
And they would be responsible for losses that you may incur or injuries.
That's right. We asked
damages,
them,
yeah.
What are you going to do about it? And they just said, no. They just said, no. They don't know anything about it. Mm. It's not their dog. The dog did not bite me.
How was their English? Was it?
It was very good. Very educated people.
Not lost in translation?
Not at all. No, yeah. Not at all.
Okay, so what happened?
Then we went, we thought, my husband said, well, we'll take this further. Mm. We went to Foreign Affairs, Durco, and wrote the whole story. They contacted the embassy.
So Durco's Department of International Relations and Cooperation. You went to see them. You said, a diplomat has savaged me.
That's right.
And I want compensation.
Yes.
Can you assist?
That's right.
They obviously got hold of the consulate or the embassy, whatever, of these people, the owners of the dog.
That's right.
And they reported back to you.
Yes, and they said there's nothing we can do. They can't help us.
These people are not waiving immunity.
They're not waiving immunity. And they actually, in the end, blamed me for extorting them of money.
I've actually got a bit of the letter here. It says, this is Durco. It says, the department received a diplomatic note, da, 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 and they say here that the complainant, that is you, try to extort money by blackmailing the senior diplomat, by exploiting the dog bite case, which was nothing but an unfortunate incident. That's what,
yes,
what they said.
But then they're admitting to it.
Exactly.
So they originally denied it, and now they're admitting it and saying that you're an extortionist.
That's right. Yeah.
I mean, asking Saul, obviously asking someone for money for something is not an extortion.
Oh, absolutely not. Yeah. I mean, it's damages. That's all you want.
Just hospital fees.
Or a bit of recompense.
Yeah, so there can be no question of an extortion. Extortion is a completely unlawful act. But to say to someone, if you don't pay me, I'm going to sue you, is not an extortion.
No, it's not.
No, and we didn't even say that. So.
Yeah, exactly. What they also pointed out to you in the very letter that I read out, they say Section 15(1) of the Act, which is the Diplomatic Immunities and Privileges Act, provides that any person who willfully or without reasonable care executes any legal process against a person who enjoys immunity is guilty of an offense, which means you may not sue anyone who is claiming
That's
diplomatic
right.
immunity. And if you do, you can go to jail.
That's right. We will lose a lot.
That's quite a scary thing.
It's quite draconian.
Completely. I mean, there are historical reasons for diplomatic immunity, but using it, as you say, is just a kind of blanket protection for anyone who actually has to be a diplomat anywhere in the world is completely preposterous.
Absolutely. What's happened to these people? Did they eventually leave?
Eventually, they left the country.
Yeah. You never saw a cent. You went to an attorney even. Your attorney said, you know, diplomatic immunity, if they won't waive it, there's nothing you can do.
We tried with the embassy. They just didn't want to have a meeting.
The South African authorities did everything they could, do you believe, to help you?
I don't think so.
By the sounds of that letter, they didn't do much. They just said, it's your fault. It's your problem. Sorry, we're not helping you.
Yeah.
I mean, you were badly hurt here. There's no doubt about it. Is there any disfigurement? Is your leg a bit... I mean, we've got pictures of the scars, which we'll tweet out later. You've got to see this.
I've got terrible scars, but luckily my leg is fine. I can walk on it, use it, so... I'm just very grateful for that.
Okay, what we want to do is we want to get to the base of the law. What is the law? Does it apply to every diplomat? Let's talk to someone who really knows what he's talking about. It's Professor Henny Stradom, Department of Public Law at UJ. Welcome, Prof.
Yes, good day.
Thank you for taking our call and talking to us. I don't know if you've heard much about our story today, but our lady was badly savaged by a diplomat's dog. Sustaining terrible injuries. The embassy concerned cried diplomatic immunity. Maybe just in a nutshell, what is diplomatic immunity and does it apply just across the board?
Yes, well, the immunity that we're talking about aims at exempting diplomats and other officials enjoying immunity from the local jurisdiction of the South African courts. And we normally have to distinguish between the status of the official in question because of the fact that diplomats, for instance, just to mention one example, has full immunity while consular agents do not have full immunity. And this is regulated in terms of South African law, but also in terms of the two conventions, the Vienna Conventions we have of 1961 and 1963 on diplomatic and consular immunity.
So, Prof, let me understand this very, very quickly. Does it mean, I know in the USA there's several levels of immunity, and only the higher the rank, the greater the immunity. Is that the same here, or is everyone immune?
No. There's a specified list of people entitled to immunity, and you're quite correct. The higher the status of the person, the more complete the immunity will be. And that list is normally provided in the Government Gazette because it is based on an arrangement between the sending state, that's the state from whence the diplomat or consul comes, and the receiving state, like in this instance, South Africa.
Yeah.
And that is based on state practice going back many, many centuries, and now codified in the two conventions that I've mentioned and also in terms of South African legislation.
Isn't this a bit old-fashioned? I mean, is this still of application worldwide? It sounds a bit crazy that a man can arrive here, rape and pillage and do whatever and get away with it.
Indeed. I think perhaps it's one of those areas of international law and national law which has undergone very little change through the times, and perhaps it's time to reconsider what we have currently codified in the two conventions and South African law, because the practices we are talking about on diplomatic and consular immunity go back, even in times before Christ, 3,000 years before Christ, there were certain envoys exempted from, for instance, the death penalty and other penalties.
Mm-hmm.
But the real practice became important in the 16th and 17th centuries in Europe when diplomatic relations between the European states started to take off. And that practice was confirmed in 1814 by the Congress of Vienna. And ever since we have these practices in time, they became sort of entrenched in terms of treaty law and national law.
We have the South African diplomat that went to Norway, and he's up for drunk driving there. He's injured someone very seriously. They refused to take a breathalyzer, citing diplomatic immunity. The whole thing is pathetic. It's outrageous.
Yeah. No, there are instances really where serious crimes have been committed by diplomatic officials. Even smuggling of weapons, killing of persons, and so on. So, and those cases are documented.
Yeah.
Maybe I should just mention the remedies available.
Please, yes.
When that happens, when a diplomatic official transgresses the law of their receiving state.
Mm.
There are actually only three remedies available. The first one is to declare the person persona non grata and send him back. So that is within the discretion of the receiving state to say that we're unhappy with the conduct of this person, we don't want him here anymore or her, and please send him back.
So you kind of deport them,
deport him, and that person will then be unwelcome in the receiving state.
Okay.
The second remedy is, and I think that's probably the most important one, is when the sending state decides to lift the immunity.
Yes.
In that case, the person loses the immunity under protection and can be prosecuted or can be, involved in civil proceedings.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a matter that rests with the sending state. The third remedy is where the person is dealt with in terms of the law in the sending state, but that hardly happens.
But is it possible to charge a man in South Africa for an offense of drunk driving in Norway? Is that a legal possibility?
You mean in the case
of the consulate, of the diplomat who caused an accident in Norway?
Yeah, that is one of those kinds of offences that will not be dealt with in that way because it is not considered that serious an offence.
Yeah.
But I mean, the lifting of the immunity by the sending state is probably your best remedy in this. But for that to happen, you need the cooperation of the sending state.
Mm. Do countries actually cooperate? South Africa's not cooperating with Norway, but generally, do other countries, the third world countries?
There's not a sort of hard and fast rule, but there are instances where you will get a cooperation, especially if it deals with or involves serious crimes like murder and rape and that kind of thing.
Prof, there's one more thing I wanted to ask you. The other way around is to sue civilly in the country of the person's home. In other words, in our dog bite case, I think Marianne could sue the diplomat in his home country, but it would cost her an absolute fortune.
Yeah, that's what I said. You know, the person can be sued or prosecuted in the home country.
Yeah.
And that is indeed one of the options or one of the remedies available. But you have to take into account that there's a hell of a lot of cost involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to decide for yourself, is it worth your while, taking into account all the circumstances.
Prof, would you...
So the remedies in general are sort of not strong remedies, they are weak remedies.
Absolutely. Would you be... interested in talking about, I'm fascinated with it, and I don't know whether it's your area of expertise, Julian Assange, who is... Now, he's holed up...
Mr. WikiLeaks.
Yeah, he's in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. He's been there for the last 4 years.
That's
Sweden, I think Sweden has a warrant for his arrest, and America's out to get him. How does that work? I mean, how long can he stay there for, and how does it work?
Yeah, that is that's one of the very interesting cases that occurred in recent times. And the reason why he's being protected there is because of the fact that he fears that he might eventually be surrendered to U.S. authorities.
Yes.
And he claims that he will not get a fair trial in the United States. And that's why the Ecuadorian government is protecting him. I think his claims are sort of flimsy of not being, or that he might be exposed to unfair trial proceedings. But nevertheless, the Ecuadorians rely on that. And that is a strange phenomenon that has happened also in South Africa in the past, where people would flee into foreign embassies and seek protection. And that brings it.
Yeah, can the local authorities do nothing? They can't touch them. Is that
they can't touch them. And it happens. It happened in the time of apartheid when people sought by the South African state had to flee.
Mm.
And they would then find refuge in a foreign embassy and they were given protection. So, and we had over time quite a number of such instances also in other countries. And Assange is one of the latest where he's seeking protection by the Ecuadorian authorities. And that is an influence of human rights law. And the position is not quite clear what should be done by the authorities of the different states. But it shows that slowly but certainly human rights law is also affecting the conduct of states concerning providing diplomatic protection in these instances.
Instances, it does actually quite sound like people are finding loopholes around diplomatic immunity, and it's perhaps not being used for what it was originally intended for.
That's correct. And in this instance, like Assange, they rely on also another area of law where a state is entitled to refuse the extradition or surrender of a person to another state if that person might be harmed in the other state. Yeah. So, and that has been used in arguments also in these diplomatic protection cases that we are talking about.
Prof, what happens if the Ecuadorian embassy actually geographically moves from one building to the next?
I believe reports are that Mr. Julian actually hasn't even stepped outside. He lives in this tiny, minute little room. I think he's given two press statements on the balcony and has since scuttled back in very quickly.
Yeah. So the moment he steps out, he's unprotected. So he can then be apprehended by the British police and be handed over.
Yeah. There is obviously a solution to that. The Ecuadorians could just put him in a diplomatic bag and move him from one to another.
Or smuggle him out at night without the UK authorities knowing about it. But I think he's probably observed what's going on there.
One last question, Prof. Why Ecuador? Why did he choose Ecuador?
I'm not so quite certain about why he chose that option. I mean, there were probably a few others as well.
But you could have gone to North Korea or something.
Yeah, North Korea would have.
Perhaps not.
I think it's probably because he had information that the Ecuadorians would assist him because of some issue between Ecuador and the United States. Yeah. I think that's probably what influenced him to seek a solution there. I just read recently that there's now a case being made out that he's held without due course, due process.
Yes, the UN just ruled on Friday.
Yeah, that is unlawfully held there. So we will see how that case unfolds.
That's the voice of Professor Henny Stratum. Sir, you've been awarded the NRF Research Chair in International Law for 5 years. That's marvelous. Eh?
That's correct. Yeah.
That's very good. Thanks. And you're one of ours, Ian van Ons. Baie dankie, Prof. Thank you so much. Eh?
Thanks a lot.
It's been very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you. All the best.
I think we need break now, Kate. That was fascinating. At least we got to understand what diplomatic immunity is. I've been really wanting to know. Good. Let's break. When we come back, we're going to want to know about how to deal with a roadblock.
I think most people are interested in
it. Well, it's hairy, scary stuff. I don't know so much.
Amazing Howard Dembowski is just the man to give it to us.
Okay, we'll be right back. Don't run away. CliffCentral.com.
At Sibanye Gold, we believe leaders are made, not born. We also believe we can create a sustainable legacy by helping to develop tomorrow's leaders today. Which is why we have partnered with the Leadership Platform to nurture leaders who are committed to growing our country's economy.
We are proud to say it's an initiative that's already showing glittering results. Sibanye Gold. We are one.
When you're in the back seat with four multicolored aliens and a talking bear, you don't ask questions. Questions like,
where are we going anyway?
Can I have another cookie?
Mom, are we there yet?
Because when you can watch Teletubbies, Winnie the Pooh, and all the best kid shows online anytime for 99 Rand a month with Showmax, a long road trip goes by a whole lot faster. So get to Showmax.com and get your 7-day free trial.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg on cliffcentral.com.
I'm Gary Hertzberg with Kate Pater. We've been featuring the very brave Marian Castles. She's barking mad at the diplomat who growled at her after she demanded compensation from him after his dog savagely attacked her. He told her she was barking up the wrong tree. There you go. That's and that your bark was worse than your bite.
That's right.
And that was it.
This is so corny, all this, isn't it?
It's okay. We like a bit of corn.
Now we're going to hold you. We're going to hold you in suspense for Mr. Howard Dembowski. Before we move on to that, Saul Smith, candidate attorney, a very smart one as well with my law firm.
Thanks,
tell
Gary.
Us quickly about a few shameless abuses of diplomatic immunity that you've picked up.
Well, there's two kinds. There's the horrific ones. There's quite a lot of diplomatic immunity being abused for really horrible purposes. Like just last year, there was a Saudi prince who was accused of raping and holding captive and beating two Nepali women. And he just used his diplomatic immunity, said, no, stuff you. And he just left India. And he will never face justice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but then you get the funny ones. And there are quite a few. A few years ago, I think probably about 10 years ago, there was a Senegalese consul who was stationed in Singapore who decided that he needed a bit of extra cash. So what he did was he opened a casino inside the consulate. Now, gambling was completely illegal in Singapore at the time. So here's this guy. He's got the only casino in town, and he is just raking in the money. And he's thinking, I'm immune. No one can touch me. They can't even come into the consulate. But
it's a smart idea.
That's a fantastic idea.
Yeah.
Little did he realize that it was a consulate and not an embassy.
So he didn't actually have immunity.
So the cops came, they raided it, and off he went.
I hope he made hay while the sun was shining, because I don't think being in a Singaporean prison would be terribly.
It's probably not
so nice. What about the guy who was smoking on a plane, and they said
fantastic.
They wanted to have him arrested. He said, stuff you as well.
Absolutely.
I'm a diplomat. Crazy stuff.
Well, he was quite brilliant. What a character. He's on a domestic flight somewhere in the States. And I'm not quite sure. I think it was Qatarian, I think. And he decides he wants to have a smoke. But he doesn't want to have a cigarette or a little thing. He goes to the bathroom and he lights a pipe. And he puffs on his pipe for 10, 15 minutes. And the cabin crew start smelling smoke, and they, you know, knock on the door, what are you doing? And he comes out and he's like, oh, I'm just having a smoke. And they think that he's a terrorist.
Because he's smoking.
Probably because he made some remark about something. And also it was America, racial profiling, all the rest of that. We don't need to get into that. But they think he's a terrorist. So they call ground control, who call up F-16s to escort this domestic aircraft to landing. And, eventually when they land, he says, sorry, I'm a diplomat, and he went home.
You know what? These laws have got to be revised. There's no doubt about it. This can't continue. It's
absolutely crazy.
People are really getting away, literally, with murder in some cases.
Well, that's it. I mean, really, I think the idea behind diplomatic immunity initially was to allow envoys to go from country to country and not be subject to particular laws. So you couldn't arrest them, you couldn't charge them with treason, you couldn't do whatever that is.
It should be there to allow the diplomat to do their job.
That's exactly
it. Shouldn't be there for the diplomat to flaunt his rights.
Absolutely. Well said.
There's a man who's chomping at the bit, and that's no underestimation. Howard Dembowski, welcome to you, sir.
Good afternoon to you, and good afternoon to the listeners. And Gary, may I make a suggestion for you?
I can't stop you. Whatever you do, I can't stop you, so you go ahead.
Don't give up your day job. You make a lousy comedian, my friend. Stick to the law.
He's always hurtful. Okay, Howard, I don't know why I get you on my show. You abuse me every time.
But he makes us laugh.
Yeah, he does. Not at my expense.
Let's do a dead bite. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, look, I've been listening to your rather fascinating discussion with respect to diplomatic immunity, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, if anyone's looking for career guidance and they have criminal tendencies, apply to the diplomatic service. apply to the diplomatic service. You can go and commit crimes all over the place. Unfortunately, one of those diplomatic criminals didn't read the handbook, because that handbook would have told that particular person that if you commit a crime in South Africa and then you get dispatched to another country, you're not immune from prosecution. And our dear former Minister of Transport, Spoon de Bailey, is up on charges of corruption and money laundering to the tune of 10 million rand, is out on bail at the moment, and that bail amount was 10,000 rand, and he's currently back in Australia doing his patriotic duty of representing South Africa's band of criminals. It's rather sad. But it goes further than that, insofar as I heard the professor mentioning that being under the influence of alcohol, driving into a person and injuring them is not a serious crime. I think that our current Minister of Transport would disagree with that, given the fact that in January this year, she turned around and in a knee-jerk reaction to the greatly increased, wrote the statistics over the past festive season, which I might add is the highest festive season road death toll that we've had in South Africa's recorded history. Minister Peters turned around and said that she's engaging with the Department of Justice to make road traffic offences the Schedule 5 offence. In other words, that a person who is accused of that particular offence must appear before a magistrate and must give compelling reasons why he or she should be granted bail, and it would be in the interests of justice. Now, you know, clearly, the matter of our diplomat over in Norway going and driving into somebody while he's blasted out of his skull is a problem. However, prosecuting that person in South Africa would be an even bigger problem, given the fact that our law requires that you take a blood sample from that person within 2 hours of their arrest. Now, given the fact that that person refused a breathalyzer test in Norway, which I can only assume is legal there, that person can't even be prosecuted in South Africa. So it's a very, very sad state of affairs. But you know, let's face it, people who drive under the influence of alcohol in South Africa are very rarely successfully prosecuted. In fact, only 6% of the matters that come before our courts are actually a result in conviction.
But why is that? Why is that so bad? What is the problem there?
Well, we have a monumental failure with respect to our state laboratories in South Africa. And unfortunately, since the case of the state versus Hendricks of 2011, the use of evidential breath testing equipment has, in fact, been put on hold in our criminal courts due to a number of different issues that were raised in that particular judgment. I am informed that it shouldn't be too much longer before we see another test case being brought before the Western Cape High Court using evidential breath testing. Mm-hmm. And hopefully they get that right, because if you have a look at the state of the Johannesburg State Laboratories, for example, on their pathology lab. Now, I'm not talking about chemical toxicology, et cetera, but I am talking about their toxicology lab with respect to pathology. They have a current backlog of 10 years.
Oh,
now, to have a decade's worth of backlog, obviously you can appreciate that is problematic to the life insurance industry and in a number of different other cases, including criminal matters. So let's just hope that this particular matter in the Western Cape is successful. Besides which, you know, if one has to sit and wait for blood results to come back, it's really a time-wasting and time-consuming exercise. Evidential breath testing is accepted in countries like Canada, in Australia, in Germany, where as anal as they can get. And it should be acceptable in South Africa.
Just one question. If somebody pleads not guilty to driving under the influence, you say that to get his blood results can take years. So the matters don't get finalized here. Is that kind of what's happening practically? And do they get withdrawn? What happens?
Well, the state provisionally withdraws drunk driving matters in almost every single instance in South Africa at the moment due to the inefficiencies of the state laboratories. And that's a very sad state of affairs, because if you think about it, alcohol is one of the leading contributing factors to fatal collisions. And the fact is that if you are giving people or sending these people that message that the chances of you being convicted are relatively low,
yes,
people are going to continue to take chances.
But they do. That's the fact of it. People do. You know, everyone knows that they can't nail you, really. So you could get locked up. That's the only thing initially when you get caught. But I think
that might be part of the reason of the Minister of Transport's assertions that it should be reclassified as a Schedule 5 offence. Mm. The sad part of that is that just as much as there are clearly drunk people who are arrested for driving under the influence of alcohol, there are also sober people who are arrested and charged with driving under the influence of alcohol. Mm. And a very good case in point is Zizi Kodwa, who is the ANC spokesperson, who, by the time he was actually arrested, had not touched alcohol in more than two decades.
Yeah.
But he was charged with driving under the influence of alcohol. He was acquitted. And if you're going to now go and retain that person in custody until such time as their matter gets heard, or alternatively, until such time as they can prove to a magistrate why their release on bail prior to the conclusion of their matter will be in the interests of justice, can you just imagine the kind of civil suits that we're going to have? I'll tell you what, if that actually happens, I'm telling you right now, I'm going to go on an intensive course to do my LLB just so I can sue the state.
You don't need it. Howard,
How would you know more than most of us?
Let's move on to something that we've been reading about. There was an article last week in the Times that said, expect roadblocks galore, is the quote. Major headlines. That's a big concern to all of us. What to do at these roadblocks? Are the cops trying to arrest us? What are these roadblocks up to do? What do they want to do? What's the purpose?
Well, unfortunately, our Johannesburg Metropolitan Police Department has a very long history of not understanding the law and misapplying the law, and it has an even longer history of being the most greedy. Being run by the most greedy metropolitan municipality on the planet, never mind in South Africa. This is all about the fact that the JMPD and the RTI are compelled to use registered mail in order to send out camera speeding fines. And they don't very much like that because, number one, it costs them money. And the last thing they want to do in order to generate revenues is to invest monies. Goodness gracious, I mean, how ridiculous is it to actually ask them to invest anything in it, let alone take the fine monies once they've got them and do something constructive towards road safety. But that's another issue. Your question is, what do you do if you're stopped in one of these roadblocks?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Edna Momignani last week asserted on another radio station that they will serve you with your Auto 03 infringement notice there and then so that you've got it and you can deal with it.
Is that the one for not paying a traffic fine?
No.
What is that one?
They actually want to serve you with your traffic fine in roadblocks. So,
how are they proposing doing that?
Yeah, well, exactly. It's rather sad that Edna Momignani and her colleagues have apparently not been given the ability to actually read statutes, and in particular Regulation 3.1b of the ARTO regulations, which says that if you're going to issue a camera traffic fine, you must issue and serve it by registered mail within 40 days of the infringement.
They're probably taking legal opinion that serving personally is as good as registered mail, if not better. I guess that's what they're trying to say.
No, they can take whatever legal opinion they like. Unfortunately, we have a very interesting state of our law with respect to the interpretation of statutes, and the ordinary meaning needs to be applied to that. So it's rather unfortunate. You can go take as many legal opinions as you like. I'll challenge you in court, and I will take you out.
Is there any attempt to arrest anyone at a roadblock? That's what I think is the hairy, scary part of all this. Are we in danger for not having paid one of these fines?
You're in absolutely no danger whatsoever. What you need to understand is the Administrative Adjudication of Road Traffic Offences Act is a migration to a PAJA process, the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. Yeah. Essentially, what happens under the ARTA Act is things called infringement notices, courtesy letters, and enforcement orders exist. And those are the various steps in the process of a traffic infringement that is being issued under the ARTA Act. There is no warrant of arrest at any stage of an infringement notice.
Forgive me for interrupting. If he says to you, if you don't pay me something or you're fine, I'm going to arrest you, do I tell him to...
Then you stick your hands out of the window and present your wrists to that person and say, please, I need the money. Mm-hmm. It's very, very simple. You can turn around and say to that officer, please give me a list of the outstanding infringement notices you allege I have, and I will deal with them in the prescribed manner. Simple. If they insist that they want to arrest you, then let them blooming well arrest you and institute a civil claim, because you will be successful in that civil claim.
Yeah, I don't think anyone wants to be thrown in the back of a police van. I mean, you've got your wife and kids or whoever's in the car. Yeah.
Look, it's a lot better than being thrown in a police cell, because SAPS will actually refuse to take you in if there is no warrant of arrest against you. So
you'll sit in the van for a couple of hours?
So you're sitting in the back of a van. I mean, there are worse things that could happen to you. Let's be very honest about it. You know, if you're going to sit in the back of a van for 2 or 3 hours and you're going to get settled 30, 40,000 rand for your troubles, you know what? I'll sit there for 3 hours.
So how would I know, but you're an activist, and most of us are peaceful pacifists, and we love life and moment.
So you are all activists at heart.
All we want our listeners to know is that they cannot be arrested and thrown into the back of a van in the normal course. And if that's threatened, it's nonsense, unless they show you a warrant which there won't be one for. Is that right?
You have the absolute right to demand to see a copy of a warrant of arrest. And if one doesn't exist, they cannot arrest you. They can arrest you for a major road traffic offence, like driving under the influence of alcohol, or excessive speed, reckless or negligent driving, failing to stop at the scene of a crash, etc. Those serious road traffic offences, of course you can be arrested for them. But in the ordinary course of things, you cannot be arrested for a minor road traffic infringement.
One other question before we let you go. What about taking pictures on your camera of the policeman? Is that a good idea, bad idea? Will that antagonize him and upset him or her? What are we doing?
It depends entirely on how one goes about that. You know, if you do it discreetly, there's nothing to stop you from doing it. In fact, there's nothing in law to stop you from taking a photograph of any law enforcement officer in public. It's very, very simple. And in fact, when they get shirty and they arrest people for taking photographs of them committing crimes, for example, they always come unstuck. But that doesn't alter the fact that if you're going to take out your cell phone, because your cell phone's got a nice high-resolution camera in it, and you shove it in the face of that traffic cop, you're going to have a similar kind of situation to the Mr. Clive Naidoo's of this world.
Yeah.
And you're going to have smart-ass cops either getting into a verbal altercation with you, or in fact getting violent with you. And obviously getting violent with you is not what you're looking for.
Good. Okay, that's Howard Dembowski. Very quickly, what are you up to, Howard? Are you doing something big in the courts at the moment?
Yes, indeed. Well, as I mentioned earlier, it is a legal requirement in terms of the ARTA Act, Section 30, subsection 1 of the ARTA Act, says any document required to be served in terms of this Act must be served on the infringer in person or by registered mail. Regulation 3.1b then turns around and says that they must use registered mail. And unfortunately, since the onset of ARTO in the JMPD's and TMPD's jurisdictions, not one single document has been sent by registered mail. They've all been sent by a service either called Secure Mail or hybrid mail.
No, you're saying it's not good enough. You're saying that's not good enough. Howard, I have to say goodbye to you. We're running out of time. Just to our listeners, please look at Howard's webpage. It's JPSA, Justice Project South Africa. And there's so much interesting stuff there. Please follow Howard Dembowski. You won't go wrong. And thank you for all you do for us as the public. We appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, we need more people to become members of Justice Project South Africa. Just go to our website, www.jp-sa.org, and click on join. The fact is that we're going to be fighting this matter with the RTIA and the issuing authorities on behalf of our members, and obviously the public will benefit from that.
Thank you. Thank you, Howard Dembowski. We'll talk to you again. Thank you, Kate Pater.
Thank you.
Marion Castles.
Thank you.
I'm sorry you didn't get your money, but you heard the law. Doesn't help you, does it? Saul Smith.
Thank you.
Well done, Saul. Duncan, my boss, who as usual. If you'd like to come forward with the story or other, we're here. Yeah.
Please let us know. It's law@cliffcentral.com. Any comments, stories, or perhaps something you want to have discussed on air, let us know.
My researcher today, Brigitte Mayer. She's been terrific. Thank you very much. I think that's the end of our show, isn't it, Kate?
That's that.
Yeah. Thank you so much for listening, and until next. I have one silly thing. They say to the diplomat who growled at Marianne, remember, sir, when a man's best friend is his dog, in your case, sir, that dog has a problem. On that note, thank you for listening, and until next Tuesday, 12 noon, I'm Gary Hertzberg.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg on cliffcentral.com.